Now to another big story tonight. After 9/11, the Department of Homeland Security created a network of regional offices called fusion centers. The idea was to incorporate local law enforcement into the effort to stop terrorism. But some say it's just keeping track of law-abiding citizens.
Each state has set up what's called a fusion center or intelligence center or statewide terrorism task force. The coined phrase by the Department of Homeland Security is a fusion center. 9/11 happened, right? And information was segmented or seen to be segmented across agencies and across corporate America. So fusion centers were created to be a central clearinghouse for information across, you know, your federal agencies, your local state law enforcement, and then subsequently, as years progressed, inviting your private sector partners into those fusion centers. So my name is Ryan Cunningham. My professional career is an emergency service manager. I've spent the majority of my career being an emergency manager in a corporate America, which is a very unique skill set. Most people would go directly into the public sector. I chose to take that skill set into corporate America, mainly business continuity, emergency management, how to help companies survive, you know, worst case scenario events, overcome and mitigate obstacles, and obviously help a company succeed through those worst case scenario events, and also being a liaison, you know, with our public sector partners in order to provide resources for them and ensure that we have the resources we need and they have the resources they need, and building and fostering a lot of those relationships. I worked in critical manufacturing. It's a Fortune 100 company. It's based all across the United States. And because of that role that I had and the information I had, I've since left that employer. I can't specifically discuss the name of the employer.
They call it a fusion center, but opponents call it a threat to your privacy.
Being embedded into this, you've developed these relationships, and they have what's called business emergency operations portions of it. So they have a business emergency operations center. And what they would do is they would invite their private sector partners in their critical infrastructure sectors, representatives, especially of your major Fortune 100 companies, giving some private sector entities or personnel up to secret level clearance of government record access.
The InfraGuard program provides a vehicle for public-private collaboration with the US government to expedite the timely exchange of information.
Most people in corporate America are gonna be like, you have a three-letter agency that comes knocking on you. Well, you wanna make sure you're doing the right thing. They come knock and say, hey, we want you to join, you know, InfraGuard, be a part of it. We think it'd be a good membership. You get in, you go to these meetings, the FBI starts sharing intelligence and resources and making you feel a part of the team.
InfraGuard has chapters across the United States with tens of thousands of members, each dedicated to contributing industry-specific insight and advancing national security.
They're offering to bring you into the fold, what the critical threats are right now, you know, what you could find that could be a threat to your company and how to mitigate it. We'll give you resources on how to overcome maybe cyber attacks or how to overcome industrial espionage. And they really lure you in. That level of trust and mutual respect, that brings you into the fold. That brings, you feel a part of something. You feel special. You know, at the time, it's almost you feel like, I'm doing my patriotic duty to help this country, right? Fundamentally, at face value, it looks like it's an asset to the community. It looks like it's an asset to a response initiative and a response effort. You have your public and private sector partners working together. You are collaborating with resources. You're ultimately moving forward for the good of the country. Here's the caveat to that. If it's manipulated and used for bad, where's the line drawn? The company is acting as an agent, which is an individual, right? And they can share as much information freely with the federal government as they so choose. I do know of specific companies that have invited them in to look at their servers, to give them threats assessments, or provide intelligence on employees. It'd be nothing to pick up the phone. Hey, you know, I may be looking into John Doe. You know, what do you guys know about him from his employer, right? You're having these off the record, unofficial conversations in which they can gather intelligence that they would normally have to either maybe get a warrant or a subpoena for.
And This afternoon, we're announcing new guidelines for every American to follow over the next 15 days. As we combat the virus, each and every one of us has a critical role to play.
When the announcement came in March of 2020 for the general public, we'd actually received a few days notice prior that this was going to happen, that, you know, they were going to do this 2 weeks to slow the spread, essentially shut America down. A lot of discussions were taking place on how to handle this and what the mitigation efforts and initiatives were going to be. And it was a lot of back and forth. And I think it's important for people to realize that this decision-making process wasn't just done with the government or FEMA or DHS. The policies that are developed were also developed in conjunction and in coordination with their, you know, private sector partners. So all these edicts of social distancing, of masking, these are dialogues that are occurring with public sector partners, with private entity relationships. Well, what does that ultimately result in? It results in, you know, people in my position and other Fortune 100 companies, they're gonna willingly implement them within their own corporations, their own entities, when maybe there really wasn't the force of law or administrative agency behind it to actually have to do it. I was very integral in helping develop the policies of what does social distancing look like? How are we gonna keep the people socially distanced? What are these quarantine policies gonna look like? How are we gonna keep them away from each other whenever, you know, they get it? And I was very involved in those discussions and processes, you know, shamefully as we know today, but I did. I was 100% in support of it, and I was a part of it, up to and including, yes, these critical infrastructures should stay open, and no, these non-criticals shouldn't. I bought the narrative. I bought the propaganda machine that was being put out and implemented it and went full bore with it and contributed to the discussion. So the Department of Public Health lacks jurisdiction for enforcement action. They knew that. So they were very careful to make it feel like it was a law, to make it feel like there was consequences to when you didn't do it, when actually it was a ruse and there was no actually enforcement arm. And it was all done under the premise of guidance or regulatory administrative agency code changes that, frankly, were not able to be enforced by the rule of law. These unelected fourth branches of government, DHS, IEMA, IDPH, things like that, they would change their regulatory guidance. Right before it would get challenged in court, they would change it again. Why? Because they never wanted an injunctive ruling against them either way, so the court would call it moot. And now you have got compliance without rule of law, without an actual edict that says you have to do this. Ultimately, everyone starts doing the same thing. That's why everything looks so universal at that time, right? You know, well before the public got to go out, it was these essential sectors that were already back at work, working the entire time. That's where this process of how the general public is gonna be held to account really is put in play. Because if you think about the 2 weeks to slow the spread, critical manufacturing, critical infrastructure didn't stop going to work, right? So a lot of these things were implemented and tested within the corporate environment well before it was pushed out to the masses.
As new highly transmissible variants of the novel coronavirus continue to appear, health experts are recommending Americans wear two masks instead of just one.
This is a physical covering to prevent droplets and virus to get in. So if you have a physical covering with one layer, you put another layer on, it just makes common sense.
As time started to go on, I really started to have this internal struggle with myself. And I'm like, this is not right, Ryan. You know, this isn't what we should be doing. But I also knew the consequences of someone like myself speaking up and speaking out, going against the grain. It's, you know, that could be career ending. That could be the consequences there, just like it was for many people. So I had this real internal battle of providing for my family and doing morally what I felt was right. The very first thing that when I started to have this cognitive dissonance with myself was, I'm looking at this mask and I'm like, this isn't doing anything. This isn't helping. I have a medical practitioner's license pre-hospital. Why am I still doing this? And what I find funny, and not to circle back, but we actually put out the recommendation initially, even at the guidance of the fusion centers, masks are ineffective. They shouldn't be used. They're not effective.
Wow.
And that was some of the initial guidance. But guess what? It changed. The narrative changed. It pushed from DHS down into the fusion centers. Now masking is required. And anytime I brought up to talk about, you know, this might not be appropriate anymore, I was immediately struck back with, no, this is what we have to do. And I found no allies early on of that belief. So I continue to just push forward because, you know, you're a one-man band, and to have that cognitive dissonance, it's difficult to go against the grain that early on.
The vaccine will be rolled out in four phases. Phase one, first responders, healthcare workers, police officers, and EMTs.
So as most people know, the vaccination was a staged rollout. The initial people that were allowed to get the vaccination were emergency responders, critical infrastructure people, things like that. So I got the vaccination very early on. I was like, okay, if this is what we have to do for everyone to get back to normal, it's the vaccination. And that was the narrative being pushed from within these organizations. After I got the second dose, I went immediately downhill. I got immediately sick, and 2 days later, while at work, I just collapsed into a tachycardic incident, had to be transported to the hospital. I was actually standing in what was my supervisor's office at the time, collapsed on a couch. I felt the walls closing in on me, and I actually was saying my last prayers. I thought I was done. No one wanted to talk about it. Everyone's like, oh, you know, it's okay. It's got to be something else. And I'm like, this is not okay. Someone doesn't have their heart rate randomly jump up to 180 beats per minute while sitting still. I mean, I've got the data on my Apple Watch Health app where you see the spikes of my heart rate randomly from a sedentary state sitting at a resting heart rate from 60 to 80 beats a minute up to 180 beats a minute. That is not, that's not common, and this continued to increase over time.
You trust us.
You trust us.
You trust us with your life. You trust us with those you love.
So trust us when we say,
get vaccinated against COVID-19.
I was expected to participate in initiatives to push the vaccination with our upper echelon up to and including commercial productions and videos and hosting vaccine clinics on site and getting access to the vaccine, you know, early on for critical infrastructure. And it just, knowing what I went through, it just tore at me. And I'm like, I can't do this. I cannot in good faith continue to go down this road. That led me to ultimately make a change. And I'm like, I can't stand for this anymore. I can't be a part of this network of infrastructure anymore. I can't be associated with, you know, these initiatives through DHS or fusion centers or even my role as an emergency manager. And ultimately it's what caused me to leave my position in a Fortune 100 company, you know, a lucrative position, and walk away from it all to help others, you know, to stop this from happening to other people.
Millions of Americans are facing deadlines as vaccine mandates take effect. As of today, about 67% of adults in this country are fully vaccinated.
A mandate is not a law. And people started using the word mandate synonymous with an enforceable regulation. And it's absolutely not. But the narrative was positioned so strongly that most people acquiesced and completely disregarded the fact that they didn't have to do it. And even to this day, you'll have people, well, we were mandated to do it. The word sounds so strong and it sounds so deep that you feel that as though it's equivalent to the rule of law, but it's absolutely not the same.
In creating OSHA, Congress affirmed the right of every working man and woman to safe and healthful working conditions.
Would you sell me your legs for $10,000? You know, it's
comes down to that, which is more important, money or your health.
So what most people don't understand is when the vaccination first came out, OSHA put out a non-binding regulation that said, if you force this vaccination on your employees, you as the employer are 100% responsible for any adverse events and their health care subsequent to therefrom, if the employer mandates it. Then we had the change of administrations, and the mandate now became an administrative regulation. And that regulation said, if you had more than 100 employees, or you had federal government contracts, that you were responsible for having your employees vaccinated as an OSHA regulation.
President Biden's now pressuring private companies too, directing the Labor Department to require businesses with 100 or more employees ensure their workers are fully vaccinated or provide a negative test each week. A move the White House estimates will impact 80 million Americans. Companies that do not comply could face fines. The White House anticipating lawsuits.
We're going to protect vaccinated workers from unvaccinated coworkers.
And they put that regulation so far out, the date of compliance, but they made the narrative that you gotta get it done now. There was a forward-looking date when the mandate went into effect. They started pushing this narrative that we're gonna give you $10,000 fines a day per employee, knowing full well that this reg was gonna be struck down. They got mass compliance real fast by employers putting these mandates in place.
The mandate forced employees to either get vaccinated or submit to weekly testing in order to collect a paycheck. It impacted more than 80 million Americans who work at businesses that employ more than 100 people.
They knew that this regulation on its face would be struck down. There's not a set of facts or circumstances that they knew that would support this initiative. Employees knew our livelihoods are at stake, right? I've got these corporate entities telling me I have to do this. If I don't do this, I'm gonna lose my job, lose my employment. And these corporations, through these private partnerships with the fusion centers, had on-site vaccination clinics. They made it so easy and so quick for these employees to get it done. Most of them acquiesced because they felt they had no other choice.
Jonathan, if you're with us, Professor, can you weigh in on what we've just gotten from the court halting the COVID-19 vaccine rule for U.S. businesses for now? What does all this mean?
It's really the OSHA case. It was that mandate that President Biden's chief of staff, Ron Klain, celebrated as a, quote, workaround. Supreme Court justices continually ask for the authority that it was being used here. And they referenced Ron Klain's statement. Mm. And as I've said before, the justices are not into workaround, you know, because it's a workaround constitutional authority.
Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker made a big move, announcing a new statewide mask mandate for all Illinois public and private schools.
Even daycare centers are included.
When I left my position in corporate America, ultimately I was doing advocacy work. I found one, literally one attorney that was brave enough in the state of Illinois to go against the government and to tell them that their administrative actions didn't have the force and the rule of law.
Tom DeVore is representing several people in Illinois asking courts whether their county is dealing with a public health emergency.
If there's no disaster in Clay County, I can assure you I'm gonna have a client that's going to go to the Clay County school districts and say, let my kids in that school. You can't keep us in remote learning because it's not allowed, there's no disaster. That's gonna be the same across all of these counties.
I was initially a little aggressive to him, like, hey, I think we can do something about this. I'm seeing what you're doing here, and I think we can, you know, partner in order to ensure kids return to school without these mitigation measures, ensure kids return and teachers return to school without being forced to get vaccinated and have their livelihoods terminated. So, you know, through those advocacy initiatives, we reached out and the mama bears came out in droves, and you know, we all talk about it, but kids suffered. And, you know, hell hath no fury than to scorn mama bear. And they fought like heck to ensure that their kids were protected. So we got them together. We, you know, had about 7,000 of them that came together. And ultimately, we filed an injunction that, hey, if you want to do this, you got to get a court order from a judge. What we used against them is the Public Health Act that specifically states, in order for the government to do this, they must get an individual order of quarantine to vaccinate or mask anyone, because it's a form of modified quarantine. So if they wanted to exercise that force, they would need to take each person before a magistrate, and the magistrate would have to order that, because that's what the law said. This acquiescing that everyone has to do it because an administrative agency says so isn't true. And in fact, that law is on almost every single state's books. And they would have had to go through that effort for all 7,000 people individually, and the burden of proof to make someone do that is extreme. The teachers union sent their head attorney to try to intervene in the case. So during the course of this trial, it's very interesting. The Chicago Teachers Union, which is the largest school district in Illinois and one of the largest in the nation, was trying to create so much political pressure around it that they staged a walkout the day of the trial and left these kids stranded to put that much pressure on the court. Ultimately, we prevailed. And what the judge said specifically will always resonate with me is, this is the evil the law was designed to constrain. Meaning the government taking actions on a mandate that they have no lawful authority to do. This is the evil the law was designed to constrain. While we were in the courtroom, people followed myself and Tom on social media, and every day we'd get on there and do live streams and encourage people to stand up and to speak out. And we get hundreds, sometimes and thousands of people that would tune in live, and they would turn into hundreds of thousands of views. We had hundreds of thousands of views of day one of the hearing. Day two, I pre-scheduled the live stream where everyone knew it was gonna happen. No sooner do I get ready to go live, because there was a countdown, I'm immediately locked out of not one, every single one of my social media accounts. Every single social media account I was locked out of, and we could not get it out. What is the coincidence of literally moments, minutes before this is about to go live, I'm locked out of every single one of my social media accounts, and they're saying it's suspected fraud. You have these private-public partner relationships in corporate America that also include your social media aspects, right?
It has been almost 1 year since the first bombshell Twitter files.
I think the most alarming thing that we saw was the regular stream, organized stream of communication between the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, and the largest tech companies in the country. They had an organized system for flagging content, not occasionally, but in enormous numbers, involving spreadsheets of accounts that ran to the hundreds and thousands.
The entire purpose of the Twitter files was a behind-the-scenes look of how Twitter employees and executives were directly coordinating with these non-governmental organizations, these fusion centers, the FBI, DHS, intelligence agencies, and sharing voluntarily information about social media users with them, with the government. The government would provide some feedback and resources, and then they may or may not censor people. More often than not, they did, especially as it related to COVID. When did we get to a point that science became not allowing competing opinions and theories to be tested and objected? That's not science anymore. It's propaganda from one direction. So when the news story came out, right, it definitely had a spin. They were quick to point out it only applies to the named plaintiffs. So in some schools where you may have only had three or four plaintiffs, you'd have the rest of the school in a mask and you'd have them forced to get in a vaccination because it's a temporary restraining order. 700 plus other school districts that weren't a part of the litigation said, we're not doing this anymore either. The ruling came out on a Friday, and we sat and watched online from Friday through Sunday all these emergency board meetings in which boards changed their policies, their rules, and defied the governor's executive orders and his mandates. After those news articles are immediately released, and you have school districts by the hundreds saying, yeah, we're not just going to make our two do this, we're doing it for the entire school. You have school districts that weren't even involved saying, we're making it apply to our entire school. And you have this flip of what the media narrative is saying versus what is actually happening transpire. And they did not want to cover that story. This pandemic was one of the largest wealth and power transfers that we had ever seen. Corporate America received significant wealth transferred to them, major pharmaceuticals. We've seen government amass large amounts of power over its citizenry. Who is left hurting still? Think about that critically. Where we started and where we are today, where is the average American citizen left standing? They're left with less wealth, less money, forced into compliance or else. And you have corporate America that has grown in massive wealth, specifically Big Pharma. Massive profits. So after every major incident in the Fusion Center emergency management world, you sum it up, and even in the military they do this, is something called an after action review. So I would challenge, you know, the general public to perform their own self-assessment, their own after action review, and look at how it affected you personally, your family, how, you know, the narrative has changed, and civil liberties were violated. And you should never violate the Constitution in the name of safety. So anytime someone says, we're doing this to keep you safe, that should be a warning and a flag for you to think critically and to understand that there may be some unintended or intended results or consequences that the government is trying to get out of this.